Good evening. My name is Meg Stemmler. I produce programs with Live from the NYPL with the director, Paul Holdengraber. One of the missions of Paul Holdengraber, in addition to making the lions roar, is to create cognitive theater. It has been quite a theatrical season so far, with evenings presented on Hallucinations with Oliver Sacks, Dance with William Forsythe, Opera with Peter Gelb, Disaster with Rebecca Solnit, Capitalism and Its Future with Indra Noori and Neil Ferguson, and many others. And there is more to come. On Monday, we will have Wes Anderson in conversation with Noah Baumbach about the film Fantastic Mr. Fox. On November 12th, we welcome another great filmmaker, Volker Schlondorf, for a conversation with Kati Martin, and we will end the season with an evening with the Velvet Underground. I invite you to tune into video and audio from these programs on the NYPL website. Live is also featured on Flavor Pill, The Daily Beast, Facebook, and Twitter. Please consider supporting these programs and your library by becoming a friend. For just $40, your friend's membership will get you discounted tickets all live from the NYPL programs, as well as discounts on books. You can visit the information table on your way out to join. In 2002, Paul LeClaire, president of the New York Public Library, called William Grimes to ask him if he would be interested in developing an exhibition from the menu collection to let the public know about the rich materials that are available within these walls. William Grimes was, in fact, very interested and went on to curate New York Eats, an exhibition that included 255 menus, photographs, prints, magazine covers, and other items drawn from the 25,000 vintage menus in the library's collection. Some special menus from our vast collection are featured here tonight. If you haven't yet had a chance to see them, Michael Inman, curator of rare books at the NYPL, and Jessica Pigza, librarian of the Rare Books Division, will be by the display cases and available for questions after the program. It is a pleasure tonight to welcome back William Grimes to the New York Public Library for a discussion on his newest book, Appetite City, The Culinary History of New York, and take us on a historical tour of the city's dining culture with writer and editor Ruth Reichel and restaurant owner and chef Dan Barber. We would like to thank tonight's corporate sponsor, Southwest Airlines, for making this possible. William Grimes was the restaurant critic for the New York Times from 1999 to 2003. He's the author of Straight Up, Around the Rocks, and My Fine Feathered Friend, and the co-author of the New York Times Guide to the New York City Restaurants, 2004. He was named New York Times obituary writer in 2008. Ruth Reichel was the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine for 10 years. Her books include A Feastiary, Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples, and Garlic and Sapphires. Dan Barber opened Blue Hill at Stone Barns and Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture in 2004, and is the restaurant's chef and owner and the center's creative director. After the discussion, we will have an audience Q&A. Please come to the standing mic, which will be in front of the stage. It's important to emphasize that you do indeed ask questions rather than make statements or lengthy comments. Live is proud to be in partnership with our independent bookseller, 192 Books. Tonight, 192 will be selling books by both William Grimes and Ruth Reichel, and both authors will be signing after the program. Before Rebecca Fetterman, our culinary collections librarian, comes to speak about the menu collection, we will show you an animated clip created by our artist in residence, Flash Rosenberg. Flash draws the conversations between authors and speakers in real time. She traces how ideas might look as they mingle in the room and land on us while our minds actively participate. Flash will be in the back of the room drawing tonight's conversation. Since our focus is on food, we hope you will enjoy this conversation portrait titled A Day at El Bui, featuring Ferran Adria in conversation with Harold McGee and Corby Kummer.
Properly introduce Corby Kummer, Harold McGee, and Maestro Ferran Adria, Bill Buford.
I think there's two ways to approach Ferran Adria, as a god and as a mortal. As a god, he's the person that Alain Ducasse described the greatest chef on the planet. As a mortal, he's just a guy in the kitchen. But first, I wanted to make a few random observations about my first meal at El Bulli. The meat course was course 35, and it consisted of three baby pigtails, beautifully crisp, beautifully fried on the side of the plate. Sweet things like chocolate were savory things like beets were sweet, And everything was all confused until we got a Szechuan button, which electrified our tongues, and we were all utterly in this man's power. Tonight, Ferran Adrià is going to be questioned and interrogated by two of our most formidable writers of food, Corby Kummer, who's a great advocate of slow food, and Harold McGee, who is the smartest man on food alive. McGee, it is my privilege to introduce possibly the greatest chef ever, Ferran Adrià God.
Del taller todo el mundo habla y casi, es decir, en el del bullito que mucha gente habla y no ha estado casi nadie.
A lot of people talk about the bully, but very few people have actually been.
Del taller del bully hay un mito bastante equivocado.
As far as the taller, the workshop, there's a bigger myth.
La gente igual se puede imaginar que hay probetas y cosas allá llamados raros.
People may think it's like a proper science lab, you know, with testing tubes and the likes.
Para nada.
And it's not at all like that.
Hay cocineros.
There are chefs, cooks.
Cuchillos.
Knives.
Y mucha, mucha pasión por la creatividad.
And with a very great passion for creativity.
¿Y cómo empezamos?
So where do we start? How do we do it?
Empezamos una silla, una mesa.
Started off with just a table and a chair.
Y 20 libros.
And 20 books.
You stopped serving bread because you said that anyone can get bread anyplace else in the world. They have to come here for what only I can give them.
No, yo me doy cuenta un momento en mi trayectoria.
I realized at a very certain moment in my career
que hay algo que no funciona en los restaurantes.
That something wasn't working in restaurants.
Sobre todo en restaurantes de cocina de vanguardia.
Especially avant-garde restaurants.
Si ahora voy a casa de Harold.
If I go to Harold's home.
No tengo carta, no hay una carta allí.
I don't get a menu.
No, me sentaré en la mesa.
I'll sit at his table.
Harold me hará la cocina que él quiera.
And Harold will cook whatever he pleases.
No hay una carta donde pueda decir, Harold, por favor, ¿me puedes traer una ensalada de tal?
I can't ask Harold, hey, can I get this salad?
¿Cómo es posible que en un restaurante de cocina avant-garde pueda haber una carta?
So I thought, oh, how is it possible that an avant-garde restaurant should have a menu?
But you know, it was 35 dishes and there's no menu. Because the whole idea is you're constantly surprised, you're constantly taken off balance. And there would be no point in having a menu because it's all new experiences you've never had before.
But the first thing that hits you is just how beautiful the dishes are. And then they're delicious. There were dishes that I was puzzled by. I really had no idea how they were done. The second time I ate there, I actually ate at the kitchen table, and Ferran was there to explain how things were done, if we wanted to know. The one that came to my mind is actually something that was very simple, but completely inexplicable, and that was a cup of coconut. Tasted like the most intense coconut I've ever had. When you're presented with something on the plate, you don't say, oh man, that must have been done in a vacuum dehydrator. How interesting. It's, that's the best piece of coconut I've ever had in my life. Well, cooks are now pushing the limits of what they do and know so much that they're actually creating new areas for scientists to work in because we don't really know what's going on when, for example, you cook an egg at 63 degrees Celsius for 24 hours. Scientists can't tell you what the proteins are doing to give you the kind of creamy texture that you get in the white. Sous vide cooking, that involves cooking meat for maybe 2 or 3 days at relatively low temperatures, but it has a texture like nothing you've ever had before.
Which is the goal, to make people experience food in a way they haven't before. But Ferran, do you want people to know what they're eating?
Saber de comer es muy difícil.
To know about food and eating is a rather difficult task.
Muy difícil.
A really difficult one.
Imposible.
Impossible.
¿Cuántos tipos de zanahoria hay en el mundo?
How many different types of carrots are there?
Multiplica esto por todos los productos que hay en el mundo.
Multiply that by all the different ingredients available in the world.
Y te darás cuenta que no puedes saber.
And you realize you don't, you just can't know, you won't have the knowledge.
Es muy difícil entender una comida en el bully.
And it's rather difficult to understand a meal at the bully.
Como es muy difícil entender un amanecer.
Like it's very difficult to understand a sunrise.
No se entiende.
You don't understand.
Lo disfrutas y ya está.
You just enjoy it.
Tell us something you've eaten in New York that you were interested in.
Hoy hemos ido, ¿cómo se llama? Al Calz, ¿no? José Andrés. Calz.
Oh, yes, we went to Katz Delicatessen
Katz's?
This morning.
It's clear to me how driven Ferran's cooking is, not by science, but by the need to make new things, also by the need to understand how those things are made and to understand the process by which they're made.
Because we never expected
crear lo que hemos creado.
To create what we have ended up creating.
No, al final yo, la gente come lo que a mí me gusta comer.
In the end, people eat what I like eating.
Es algo tan sencillo como esto.
It's as simple as that.
Good evening. My name is Rebecca Fetterman, and I'm the Culinary Collections Librarian here at the New York Public Library. And I just want to take a few minutes to tell you a little bit about our culinary collection. Tonight, the theme of this panel discussion is on restaurant culture in New York City, and there is really no better place to have this conversation than the New York Public Library. The library's menu collection began before this building was even built, and today, with nearly 40,000 menus in our collection, dating back to the 1840s and continuing to the present day, the library's goal is to collect and secure these ephemeral documents for safekeeping and make them available to anyone who needs to consult them. As someone who has worked with the collection, I'm always amazed at how often these items are used and consulted by graduate students, scholars, fiction writers, and food enthusiasts. The menus have an ability to answer a question that isn't necessarily easy to answer. And that's, what were people eating, socially at least, in 1866, or 1916, or 1986? But their value extends beyond food and also informs neighborhood development and social history. We have the menu from Restaurant Florent, for example, because the meatpacking district today looks very different than it did in 1985 when the restaurant opened. We have the menu from the French Pavilion of the 1939 World's Fair, because how can one study the infamous Le Pavillon without referencing its predecessor? And we have the Restaurant for Diner in Williamsburg, because who knows how people will use these menus in the future. But menus aren't the only culinary-related materials we have here. As you all know, Gourmet's last issue was released this month, and for nearly 70 years, Gourmet was the food publication covering food trends, highlighting travel destinations, interviewing chefs. The library has the full print run of Gourmet, along with a host of large and small food periodicals like Sauveur and Cooks Illustrated, but also smaller ones like Swallow Magazine and The Kosher Kettle. Our collection of cookbooks dates back to the 15th century and continues to the present, in addition to other food-related materials related to everything from crops and raising cattle to cheese making. A few years ago, William Grimes curated an exhibition on the third floor of this building called New York Eats Out, and it celebrated New Yorkers' enthusiasm for dining outside of the home. Mr. Grimes created a historical narrative that began with Delmonico's in the 19th century and continued to September 11th and Windows on the World. The first time I ever stepped foot in this building was to see that exhibition, and I'm so happy he's here along with Ruth Reichel and Dan Barber, because together they contribute so much to the culinary excellence of this city. So please join me in welcoming William Grimes, Ruth Reichel, and Dan Barber.
I'm going to take a minute to say hello to you.
Yes,
we've never
met. Finally, in the flesh.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny that when you review restaurants, you avoid these people, and then you get the chance later on to meet the hand behind the food and the mind behind the food. So it's always, you know, you get a second life out of it in a way. I have to say, just starting because of that introduction having to do with the menu collection, that, you know, many books are born in the New York Public Library, and innumerable beyond our ability to count. But mine might have the closest connection to the library of all of them, because it really began with that phone call from Paul Leclerc, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, inviting me to plunge into the menu collection, which I knew of and had written about a little bit for the Times, and welcomed the opportunity to get back into it and really get my hands into those boxes. It was it was fun to do that exhibition, and out of that exhibition came the idea that perhaps a narrative could be constructed that would allow us to be a kind of a time machine of the kind that I've always fantasized about. What if I could turn the dial and go back to 1909 and dine in New York? What were people eating in 1840, and what did it feel like to be in the city? I often, when I look at photographs of the city and watch just people in bowler hats walking around, I would think, well, where are they going to eat lunch, and what is that lunch going to be, and what is it going to feel like? So this book was an extended indulgence for me in that little fantasy trip, decade by decade through the city's history. And it was full of surprises for me, because I must say that an enormous amount of it was simply unknown to anyone at the time I started researching it. It was just lay locked up in the vaults, so to speak, in magazine articles and in newspaper articles, gathering dust, and like the tomb of Tutankhamun, waited and waited through the years until somebody opened the stone door. And little did I know how hard it was going to be to nudge that door and get in there and find out what had been happening in New York all these decades ago. Now, we are in sacred ground, not just because we're in the library, but two blocks away from here, to the north, were two of the great restaurants in the city, Sherry's and Delmonico's. They faced off against each other on 44th and 5th, these two dinosaurs of haute cuisine in New York. By the 1890s, they'd moved up to 44th Street and were the colossi in the city's culinary culture. And here we are. At the time they moved, the library wasn't even here. It was, if you read The Alienist, you may recall that final scene where they run around the top of the Croton Reservoir, or what, aqueduct, I don't know what it was. You see it in the pictures, those big fortress-like walls. That was what was here before the library was, and there, two blocks away, were these two great restaurants. And Ruth, I understand that you have a connection to one of these restaurants, Sherry's.
Well, I was fortunate enough to have my Aunt Bertie, who lived to be 102 and lived alone at the end of her life, and never left New York City. So she remembered people talking about the Civil War. She remembered being taken to Sherry's as a little girl, or I don't know if it was a real memory or she was just talking about her father talking about Sherry's. But right before she died in 1980, I did a sort of culinary interview with her where I asked her about all the food that she'd eaten as a child. And she literally had never gone more than 200 miles away from New York. So her talking about restaurants was sort of much like your book. It's this gradual moving north. Everybody sort of starts downtown, and then she remembered when they moved from the Lower East Side up to the country, which was Harlem, where they had a backyard and chickens. But one of the things that she talked about was these incredible meals at Sherry's.
Oh, Lord. Well, that is mind-boggling to hear from an actual living voice, because when you're looking at these menus and the hell of it is, you can't eat the food. I mean, all you can do is you can look at it, you can note it, and you can read people enthusing over it. But like opera performances from the mid to late 19th century until the advent of any kind of sound recording, you can only wonder what those great voices sounded like. Well, what were those meals like? What did those ingredients really taste like? There's a third restaurant near here, and this is my little pop quiz for Dan, which is, there's a third restaurant, and you will get enormous bonus points if you are able to tell me anything about this.
Another star from you? If
We don't do retroactive stars. Sometimes we don't even do them the first time around. So I wish to read to you this statement of a philosophy. My theory about a restaurant is that to be the right sort of an eating place, it must be closely related to its source of supplies. When do you think that might have been uttered? And do you have any idea who might have said it?
I was going to say, I thought I said that last week.
Uh-huh.
That's not the right answer. Who would have said it? That's a tough one.
Honestly, if you know, I'll fall off my chair.
I know.
You know. I'm going to give you the proprietor of the restaurant that this person owned. Is that fair? Did the person own the restaurant? A restaurant?
Yes, this person did.
Do you know the answer?
I do.
I'm going to guess the craftsman.
You're right.
Oh, my God.
Right? Pretty good.
Yeah. You have to fall off your chair now.
I should eat the flowers in the vase or something.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question back, and this is.
I'm going to explain to you what the craftsman restaurant is in a second. But
because you have to mention who owned it, because that's
okay,
important.
Go ahead.
The craftsman restaurant was on 39th Street and 5th. It opened in 1912 or 13. I have to look it up in my own book again. Gustav Stickley was the owner, and you know him, I'm sure, as the great furniture designer.
Right.
There was a craftsman building, and it was intended to be a showcase office headquarters for the Stickley Enterprise. It was furniture throughout most of the building, and then way at the top was something called the Craftsman Restaurant. And the thing about this restaurant that anticipates what Dan does here now among us is it had its own farm. Stickley was not a restaurateur, but he had ideas about the good life and the civilized pursuit of pleasure. And he felt that in the area of food, what that meant was resistance to an industrialized food economy. It meant fresh ingredients on the table. It meant ice. He actually made ice cubes from ice that was from spring water on the farm. Which is, you know,
see,
that's
I'd be maligned if I did that today.
Right. Yeah, the fruit, the vegetable, yeah. The flowers, all this came. And, of course, the design was very different from what restaurants were very ponderous in those days. And they tended to be, if you wanted to communicate luxuriousness in a restaurant or that this is a high-class restaurant, you did it with a lot of heavy, dark wood and gloom. And this was something that he knew how to sort of take the stuffing out of all of that and created a very modern-looking restaurant. And I'm
well, that's the thing
that
I'm struck by.
What
I'm struck by with your book, besides the writing, which you know I couldn't say this when you were you know a reviewer for the Times, but your writing is amazing. I felt that very strongly when you were a reviewer, and I was reminded of it in reading this book because. Because it's so fluid, it is not showy writing, and you pack so much information into a paragraph. I mean, it's amazing when you have, I don't know how many of you in this audience have read the book. It is amazing the depth of information that's I was going to say thrown at you, but it's not thrown at you. It's sort of lovingly prepared for you, and it really is a joy to read and a great writer at work. So that's my. But second, I'm struck by is that is the description of today's New York dining scene or let's say culinary scene. So you would take like the explosion of food carts. You would look at the explosion of cultural diversity. You would look at restaurant as theater, which feels very much like a new thing, and which is to say in my lifetime anyway. You would look at the restaurant as the cult of the new ideal in a new trend. You would look at it for the desire to become to visit a restaurant that had a more bohemian aesthetic. All of these things describe today's New York culinary experience. And yet, you describe New York culinary experience at the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, very much in the same way. I'm so struck by that. It reminds me that what you just said is that I have no new ideas, and that there really are no new ideas. They're rehashing of old ones, whether we know it or not. So I guess what you wrote me an email last night about the overall trend of the overall question of your book was were they eating better than we are today? And so with that in mind, I ask you because I could not get that from your book, and I don't know if you even fully answered it. Maybe you want to answer it now.
Yeah, I don't. It's an imponderable. I think as an act of faith, just sort of understanding what was available in the markets, and keep in mind the markets in New York. This is its own subject. The markets in New York were enormous. I mean, we always kind of fantasize about Paris and Les Halles, this vast central market, and how wonderful that is. Well, New York had two markets. You know, the market we have today, the Green Market in Union Square, is a mere postage stamp in comparison to the size of the Fulton Market and the Washington Market, which covered the east side and the west side. These were vast cities within the city, and literally thousands of food vendors would be selling produce, game, fish. You could also get things like shoelaces and novels and anything else. They were kind of, you know, supermarkets tacked onto vast food markets. And when you go down the list of what they were selling there, what was available in just terms of raw products, you think, boy, I mean, when's the last time you've seen snipe, plover, and woodcock on the menu?
Well, I mean, that's the other thing that just drives you crazy when you're reading the book, is you just realize, like, we ate it all. They gobbled it all up, and they didn't leave it. I mean, you know, the oysters, which were, you know, the oyster beds were vast.
Yeah, the oyster, I mean, if you read down, it's just like list of the dead, really. It's a roll call of illustrious ancestors with names like Shrewsbury and Saddle Rock. These are oysters that were sort of at the top of the menu in these restaurants in the 1880s and 1890s, and all of them are just forgotten names. I mean, we have a couple of New York oysters that we still love, like Blue Points, and those were on the menu back then. But all the rest of them are gone. And just as you
and
say, we gobbled it all up. I mean, we shot them, we ate them, we fished them, we consumed them, and now we lament them. So, you know.
Do you think that, I mean, there is this running theme in your book of excess, whether it's a steakhouse or a lobster house or whatever the theme is. What do you attribute that to? I mean, is that an American experience? Is that a New York experience? Is that a result of the incredible ecological availability of everything that surrounded New York? What do you?
I mean, we're positioned in a lucky way. Just as a harbor, New York is in a very lucky location, and that's why it is the great city it is. And people don't think about it because it's, you know, that industrialization has proceeded apace, and we don't think about the fact that as a natural setting, it's as beautiful in its natural state. It's an abundant producer of everything, or was. I mean, the New Jersey meadowlands, they were called meadowlands for a reason, you know. And all that marsh and wetland, they supported just these vast flocks of birds that don't exist, prancing deer on 86th Street in the woods there.
But there's another reason. I mean, I think one of the reasons that there was so much excess is we're a nation of immigrants, and very poor people came here. And as they made money, one of the ways that they reveled in their newfound wealth was just to eat as much as they could. I mean, there were people who came from starving villages and were thinking about their families they'd left behind. And suddenly, you know, they ate meat maybe twice a year, and suddenly they could eat meat every day, and why not eat a lot of it?
It's amazing how trends continue.
Yeah, in some ways you get a false idea at the top end, because you tend to see banquet men, that you get a slightly exaggerated sense of what people were eating, because, you know, Delmonico's 365 days a year would just make fortunes by doing these banquets in its private halls or the private dining rooms. And if you actually see what a typical meal might be, it wasn't quite that excessive. But they ate heavy, and they you know, when people went to restaurants like that, they ate a lot. And when they went to those little cheap restaurants, they ate a lot too. I mean, these little 50-cent table d'hotes that the Italian immigrants set up down in the village after they displaced the French. Remember, Soho used to be French, you know, before it had cast iron, the cast iron district. It was an intensely French neighborhood with all sorts of little bistros, any sort of from Washington Square south. And with the 1890s, the French start dispersing, and the Italians take their place. And a lot of times, they'd set up a boarding house, and the street level would be a restaurant. And what they thought they were going to be serving Italian laborers, and they ended up, all these hipsters discovered these 50-cent table d'hotes, where you could get really 6-7 courses for that 50 cents.
But so the question, this is a Larry King softball, because I got a teaser for you coming up. But the question was, we're reading better today than we were 100 years ago. What's your gut telling you?
I think that I fantasize that we ate better 100 years ago simply because the raw material was better and more abundant and more varied.
And it came from closer.
And it came from
closer. But you know, taking the other side of that, there was bad distribution even from local sources. There was a lack of refrigeration, right? I mean, today you can pick up the phone, or I can pick up the phone and get anything I want from anywhere in the world for a fairly good price. Often the quality is quite good. How to compare that with what was available from the Meadowlands, I don't know. But there's some luxuries today that are quite efficient and quite abundant. So I don't know where you.
Well, hygiene is another thing. I often think that you had to be a brave soul to step up to a street cart and get a half dozen oysters on a half shell. I think probably many people fell by the wayside, but... sacrificed in a good cause. The other thing is, the other thing that I often thought of was how inventive were these restaurants and chefs? And the answer is, invention wasn't really a word that people applied to cuisine at the time. Right. What they tried to do in French restaurants was faithfully, at the high end, faithfully reproduce classic pre-Escoffier French cuisine, and with as well as they were able to, given the limitations in the United States. That's to an extent that's still true. If you're trying to make a perfect French restaurant outside of France, you start a couple steps with a demerit or a couple steps behind, and with ethnic restaurants again, it was not trying to invent something new and exciting and innovative. They're trying to recreate what they came with, the soul food that they came with.
Your book reminded me of how awful it would have been to be a chef, even with the abundance. The power of food creation was in the hands of the diner. The diner came to a restaurant and expected a certain listing of dishes for which were famous or known, and came with a pre-idea of what they were going to eat even before they arrived at the restaurant.
I don't think that's true. I mean, the book pretty much makes clear that when Delmonico's started, they offered a completely new menu, and people were thrilled and excited by it.
There was a real shift, and especially, as you note, in the... I think you noted in the shift with Nouvelle Cuisine where the chefs came out from the kitchen and there was this tectonic shift where you didn't arrive at a restaurant. Well, God, we just watched Ferran Adrià. We see how the evolution is really where we've come to. But back in the 60s, that was revolution. That was the Ferran Adrià's of the day, right? I mean, you've written about this, or I've talked to you about it before. But this was the shift from the diner having the power of the food to the chef. And today we're on a whole new level of that. But it was really interesting to see that evolution. And the idea of creativity back at the turn of the last century was very limited.
Yeah, and the decor was often extremely stilted. The language of interior decoration, until you got to this crazy restaurant called Murray's Roman Gardens on 42nd Street, which was this insane fantasy by a very little-known architect named Henry Milo Erkins, who combined Assyrian, Egyptian, Roman, everything into one very bizarre restaurant. It was the first theme restaurant in New York. And there was a kind of a Cleopatra barge parked next to a table on the grand ballroom or dining room on the ground floor. And there was a couple stories up. There was the Dragon Room, which was an Oriental-themed thing with some kind of a recreation of the Imperial Gardens in Peking. And it had an electric railway that ran around it, and it delivered food to each place on this train. And there was, I don't know what got into this guy, but they went on this little team. He and the owner of the restaurant, Murray, went on to create something called the Le Café de l'Opéra, the Opera Café, a couple blocks away. And that was even grander and weirder, and lasted only about a year. But other than that, these splashy big restaurants were kind of boring in the interiors. It took a while until you got sort of European modernism breaking the mold and color and spatial differentiation and different levels within restaurants, the idea of intimate spaces breaking up big open spaces. They kind of look like big assembly halls with ranks of tables in the 19th century. Rather forbidding.
Ruth, the role of the journalist in all of this, what's your, having read the book, what do you feel, or your own understanding of how New York journalists and across the country, how the role of the writer, the reviewer, the writer about food, how did this help evolve what's
well,
being described?
Well, it's such a new role. Craig Kleborn pretty much invented restaurant criticism as we know it, and you know, it wasn't that long ago. And you know, I mean, I guess you could talk about Duncan Hines before that, but it's a very new role. You know, people went where was convenient, and you know, I think that the role of the journalist has been hugely important because it sort of brings the idea of food and different kinds of food into your home. And suddenly you're sitting there in the morning and you're reading about some new kind of food. And I think that, you know, you talk a lot about Joe Baum's influence in New York. And
By the way, amazing chapter. It was just incredible to see. I knew about Joe Baum, but I just did not understand, again, that he really, as you said it perfectly, that everything after that is sort of an imitation of what he was
but
doing.
I remember being a little kid and having my mother read these reviews in the Times about Joe Baum's restaurant and saying, we have to go, you know, and being taken to La Fonda del Sol in the form of the 12 Caesars and the Four Seasons. And just because she'd read about it, I mean, her friends weren't going there. And and so, you know, I don't think you can underestimate how important writing about restaurants has been to the evolution of the really modern restaurant.
Yeah, when you were talking about the shift of power to the chef, I was immediately thinking exactly along these lines. And Gourmet was seminal in all of this, by the way. That, for one thing, Craig Kleborn, you know, kind of cut his teeth, eye teeth, working at Gourmet. He was a kind of a combination flunky and did a column called Along the Boulevards, which is little capsule reviews of New York restaurants.
And we actually still have cards in the library written in his hand.
Oh, God.
You know?
So, really? So that was like his lucky little, you know, fresh out of hotel school job at Gourmet, and then he translated, you know, he went on to bigger things, which is, as you say, essentially creating at least newspaper food journalism, and from that comes this, you know, the Food Network and the power to create star chefs. Before that, chefs were laborers in the kitchen, and they were, their identity was deliberately kept secret. I mean, the people you knew were the maitre d' or the owner of the restaurant. You had the, or the waiter. You had the relationship, and these waiters would be in these restaurants
forever.
Well,
can I, except for at Gourmet, where Gourmet always had, it was our chef, and the first chef there was Louis Diat.
Yes, he was one. He was one of the first names who became recognizable to the public. And
what year?
Turkey
the
hash.
Man who invented vichyssoise.
Vichyssoise, and he was also famous for a turkey hash.
This was in the 40s.
The 40s.
But he had been the chef at the Ritz in New York, and they made a big point of our chef. And after Louis Diat was the wonderfully named Louis P. DeGuy.
But if you go before then, I mean, in the 19th, just to show how primitive food journalism was, it wasn't until 1903 that there was an actual restaurant guide for New York. It was called Where and How to Dine in New York. It's in this collection here. Or you can go online and read it because it's profusely illustrated. You can go to archive.org, which is, I don't quite know what it is. They download books or they scan obscure books, and this is one of them. And you can see what the restaurant scene was like, at least at the higher end, in 1903. Well, there wasn't another guide until 1925, when the architecture critic for The New Yorker decided to moonlight, and he wrote a book called The Restaurants of New York. Of course, it was 1925. Prohibition had kicked in and was in full force, and the beginning of it was just this lament for the demise of all these restaurants that had gone down, just kicking and screaming, in a matter of a couple of years, Murray's Roman Gardens among them, which became a flea circus. And eventually at the very end of his life, I think in the 60s and 70s, was a gay baths where the decor finally made sense. You know? So, but the idea of restaurants as a subject and food as a subject of interest to cultivated readership that really didn't exist. And it took, it just was incredibly slow to come along. It's really surprising, given our infatuation with this topic today.
And where do you see the future here? Looking down the pike, what do you see as the influence of food journalism?
I don't think that you grow up eating great food and then one day turn around and say, now I'm going to eat junk for the rest of my life. I mean, I think, once you become a food culture, as long as you can sustain it economically, you only get more and more discerning. And I'm very optimistic about the future of food in this country.
Food as a future. Well, that's good because
better for me, Bill.
Yeah,
Grimes.
Better for you, better for me.
But what I wanted to talk about a little bit. One of the things that I really love about your book is you see the changing social role of the restaurant, and it's like one of the things that I never thought about is women couldn't go to restaurants.
It was a tough town for women for a long, long time. And one of the heroes of the book is a woman named Alice Foote McDougall, who in the 1920s took pity on the working woman who was entering the workforce in ever greater numbers. All those steno pools and typists, and in Newspaper Row, more and more women were getting employed. But when they went out at lunchtime to try to find a place to eat, they found these grubby hole-in-the-wall places that male journalists loved, and lived on for, and sentimentalized about in later years, fortunately, because that was prime material for me. But it was a very forbidding atmosphere for women, and the food, the hygiene was highly suspect. And for Alice Foote McDougall, a very genteel woman left destitute when her husband died, started out with a couple dollars in her pocket and became a coffee roaster and decided to open some coffee shops and parlayed that. She became the Martha Stewart of her day. And what she understood was that women like her were looking for a lighter kind of food, portions not as large, and surroundings that were not disgusting. And that, sometimes it's just one little insight.
Women, God, they want everything.
One little insight can make you a fortune, and it made her a fortune. She saw her assistant was a young woman, and she noticed that she was eating a slice of apple pie that she bought on the street and a cup of coffee because she didn't want to go into any of these horrible places. She decided, I got to create something that a woman could stand to go to. And an empire was born. Hmm. So there were... one of the great breakthroughs was just allowing women to smoke, which Café Martin in 1908 on Madison Square, kind of the coolest French restaurant of its day. Stanford White ate there the night he got shot to death. And that was one New Year's they decided they were going to allow women to smoke. They'd been sneaking cigarettes behind fans for years, but this was going to be wide open. And but otherwise, you had even fine restaurants. You had either there was a separate dining facilities for women, or women simply were not allowed, although the picture sort of varied depending on neighborhood and what the proprietor, the philosophy of the proprietor and so on. But it was difficult.
But there was also, I remember the clothing barrier for women. My parents took me to Côte Basque for my 16th birthday, and they wouldn't let me in because I was wearing a pantsuit.
Oh, right, the crisis of the pantsuit. Although I didn't write about this, I do recall that there were some real major showdowns between diplomats' wives in pantsuits, some very formidable women in pantsuits staring down equally formidable maitre d's, and one of the great cultural moments in the city. Of course, that and all other aspects of dress code have kind of gone the California way. And I think maybe 21 Club is the only place left where they hand you the jacket and make you put it on. Otherwise, as a reviewer, I was always appalled at going to a 3-star, 4-star restaurant and seeing some slob in a tracksuit. And usually sitting...
You and me both, man.
Yeah. Sitting with his girlfriend who had dressed up for the occasion, and I felt very, very sorry for the girl who dressed up for the date, and then this guy in the sweatshirt.
The research for the book, especially the last section of the book, is about the run up to where we are today, especially from the 1980s on, also really brilliantly synthesized into these broad themes, which was a real pleasure to read. Even though I knew a lot of the information, a lot of it also was new and fresh, and you did it beautifully. I'm wondering, did it make you want to get back into writing about food? And did you miss the days of the power you wielded? Actually, you wield another kind of power now, which has a very lasting effect.
Yes, so. I do have the last word now, let me tell you, because you don't get two obituaries. No. You can get two reviews.
Yeah, right.
Okay. But like Prospero, I laid down my scepter, and I don't regret it because I get to watch so much TV now. I do regret eating at someone else's expense at very fine restaurants, whereas now I have to think twice or thrice about walking to some of the places I might like to eat out at. And it's in some ways it's the best job in the world. There's no getting around it. And there's no way you can inspire sympathy when you talk about how hard it is to go out there night after night. the foie gras fatigue.
Yeah.
And all of that. People just look at you like they want to hit you. So just about 5 years is just, I thought, just about enough of doing that. And so I don't really have any regrets about that. And as far as food writing goes, I mean, I felt like I was doing plenty of it when I was doing this book. In fact, I was doing that for me. It was some of the most fun food writing because I was satisfying. I was scratching an itch, which was that sort of time travel lust to go back and figure out what people were, what was the city like before I got here, 100 years before I got here, and what did it feel like? And I sort of, sometimes I describe this as being sort of like The Alienist, except everybody gets to sit down and eat. You know? So it was, there was a romance to the whole endeavor that I found gratifying. So,
well, Ruth, I have to say what I know most people in this room are thinking, and what I have not yet said to you, which is, I'm very sorry about the end of Gourmet. We are. I'll speak personally, I am forever grateful for everything you did to that magazine and for everything you've given to the food world of New York and beyond. You're both an inspiration to me, and me and a lot of home cooks are grateful and deeply appreciative. So for that, we give a round of applause. So I'll just ask, what are you up to? What are you thinking about? Where are we going to see you in a few years?
Well, I'm still on book tour for Gourmet Today. We have two more books in the can that I'll probably finish, two more little gourmet books. I've just finished the first season of Gourmet's Adventures with Ruth, and I think there'll be a second season. Hmm. And I think that our other TV show, Diary of a Foodie, will go on. And I'm mostly going to be writing. Yeah.
Well, one of the losses of Gourmet, there's been tons of talk about the quality of the magazine, also the quality of the writing, which was led by Ruth, really, and she with her standards and the keen eye editorial eye brought Gourmet to a new level of writing, which sort of on a personal level, again, is just the greatest loss of that magazine, because it provided a void that's really out there. So we'll be very missed. But we also, and I know this all too well, you are going to go on and do things that affect my world only for the better. So I'm looking forward to
that. Well, I want to say, a lot of people, a lot of us at Gourmet got notes from people, but you were really special. You wrote notes to so many people. Oh. And it was like, usually it was one or two of us would, get a note from someone. But Dan really reached out
to felt so moved
a lot of so people moved, yeah. at the magazine.
You've done a lot for me. So it's a real love fest up here, as you can tell. should we open this up to some questions?
I think at a certain point,
I don't know, maybe I pulled the trigger on that too early. I don't know. But
though there usually tend to be a lot of questions and never enough time.
That's right.
So the problem is it's so dark.
Well, I got this X-ray. If anyone wants to pop up a hand, we can start this and yeah. Can you stand up and just belt it out, and then we'll.
Boring with each other near here, and you were kind of mourning the loss of the sensation of being able to eat the meals at these restaurants, the 1880s, 1890s.
Did everyone in the back hear that? It's a great question. No. Okay. You want to repeat the question?
Yeah. Essentially, it's why can't we reproduce all these? I'm complaining about not being able to taste all this food I'm reading about. Well, why can't we just reproduce it? We have the written score, but we don't know what the music was like. I think that's what I'm trying to get across.
Right.
Because we could certainly, you know, if it's classic French cuisine, and we know what the sauces were, and we know what the nuts and bolts of the dish were, but we don't know what the raw ingredients tasted like back then. And that's more than a minor point. So what did the tomatoes taste like, and what did the celery taste like, and what did those plover and woodcock taste like? I don't know that we can ever recapture all of that. So
yeah, I once listened to the most fascinating conversation between Edna Lewis and Marion Cunningham talking about how different things had tasted when they were children than they do today. And they were talking about ordinary ingredients, and it really made me feel like you can make those recipes, but you can't recapture those flavors.
I don't know that my temptation is to say exactly what Ruth said, and in fact I'm practicing my cuisine in part to recapture those lost flavors and whatnot, but there's also a point at which that becomes just nostalgia, and so I'll answer the question I asked to Bill Grimes. Were people eating better back then than were the pure taste, the flavor of food better than it is today? It's a very broad question, but I wonder if you wouldn't have tasted a lot of food back then and not been as impressed as we tend to want to think we would be. In other words, there's a lot of great farming happening locally and nationally with a great sense of combining old world wisdom of the turn of the last century, let's say, agriculturally speaking, and also utilizing innovative techniques and technology in both distribution, in from seed to distributor to marketer to chef really, and the use of technology and ideas that I would suggest have vastly improved flavor in many ways. And that's not I don't want to make a too broad a statement, but there is a sense of getting into this and thinking in a very nostalgic, why can't we just go back to the way food once was? Well, in fact, I think probably the way to move forward for better flavor, and this is something that I think Gourmet captured perfectly, is to marry both old world wisdom and new technologies, because to suggest that, which I get a lot as somebody comes up and says, my grandfather used to farm, like you're talking about, organically without pesticides. I was like, no, he didn't. No, he didn't. I want to say that to you, but no, he didn't. He might have farmed without pesticides and chemical fertilizers because they weren't readily available, but he probably was not a very good farmer. And there's tons of recorded data about that, and there's even more today to show that there is an approach to agriculture, to farming, that has far surpassed what our nostalgia begs us to believe.
Well, there is for farming, but for instance, my neighbor who is a hunter upstate brought me some little teal ducks.
Yeah.
And you can't sell, no, you can't yeah, buy them.
Yeah, right, well, that's
and
good example.
It was the most delicious duck I have ever tasted. Mm. I mean, it was, it doesn't taste remotely like any farm duck. It just doesn't.
Right.
When you think about it, if you translate it to wine, this conversation comes up a lot in terms of wine, and I think you can sometimes focus on it more easily. There was a lot of horrible, bad wine made around in France a century ago, and your chances of getting—I think the low bar got moved just a lot higher by technology, and it's very easy to get a drinkable, low-level bottle of wine, easier today than at any time in history. I mean, it doesn't hurt to understand what's going on in the barrel. And that stuff can be, technology can be misused, and you can have these kind of horribly Parkerized wines that people complain about. But you also have this whole world.
See, he's free to say that.
this whole world of wines available now to us today from, you know, Chile and Australia, produced with very sophisticated technological understanding of winemaking, that has to at least offset some of the laments you have
great,
for
great
the old
point.
Burgundy, the little farmer in Burgundy.
That's
you know.
Great point. Yes, you're at the mic.
Yes, I was instructed.
Yeah, take it away.
With all of that history in mind that you've researched and what you're all talking about.
You got to speak up.
This is terrifying. And what it says about us, what history says about us as eaters, what do each of you make of the trend right now toward tater tots and hot dogs and fried chicken and this sort of thing that's going on right now, this kind of TV dinner, sort of simple food trend? What do you think?
So the question is about what's our reactions to this trend that the questioner has proposed about processed food, cheapened food that is so readily available and abundant. So maybe we should start with you.
Well,
on
you're
that.
Asking okay, about sort of a yeah. retro trend toward an idealization of, you know, the self-consciously consumed tater tot in a fine restaurant setting, or are you talking about just, you know, really awful TV dinners and that we all agree are horrible in every way? The idealized retro trend. Well, I mean, it's it can be fun and it can be hugely annoying. I remember trashing Hudson Cafeteria, and I'm doubly glad.
Boy, I remember that too.
Having been slammed on by the owner Jeffrey Chodorow, I'm really happy that I completely stomped on this place. But it was a shrine of retro chic and idealization of really bad chop suey and all these other things. And if they could have served you a TV dinner on a tray, they would have done it. And it was, you know, you can only get so far imagining your food in quotes. And eventually you have to put it
That's
in
great.
Your mouth and eat it, and it's not so much fun then.
I mean, I just think, you know, it's what you expect to happen in a recession where suddenly everybody wants to be comforted by the food. And I think that ultimately you realize that it's not comforting. It's just annoying. And you go away from it. I mean, I think it's this idea that people have in their heads that if they go to the, you know, food of their childhood, they will somehow feel better. Mm. And then they go to it and they just feel worse.
Other questions? Yes.
Ms. Reichel, would you tell us about the month you spent a year in Provence?
Are you referring to the article I wrote in the New York Times right before I left? I wrote an article which probably got more angry mail than anything else I'd ever written. Which was, I went with my family, my large extended family, my brother and his three children and all their kids and my husband and my son, and there were 19 of us, and we rented this great big house in Provence, and I had this fantasy that I was going to be cooking fabulous food every day, and this is a while ago. I mean, it was before I left the Times, and I left there more than 10 years ago. But the truth was that the food that was available to me was not great, and I was going to these farmers markets and getting sort of food that had been brought from everywhere, and I found shopping there really difficult. I mean, if you wanted to get meat, you'd have to drive to a butcher in one place, then you'd have to drive 25 miles to get the great cheese someplace else, and the bread in the little village that we were in was inedible, and Pat Wells has barely spoken to me since this piece came out. But I think things are much better now, but there really was a point in France where they were losing their food, where the quality of the food in France just went away. And in fact, years ago, and this is like maybe 15 years ago, I did a piece about Kermit Lynch, the wine importer who lived half the year in Berkeley and half the year in his house in Provence. And he said it was far easier to be a better cook in Berkeley, where the quality of the products was so high, than it was in Provence. And so I ended up saying, you know, that this, these few weeks we spent there felt like a year, because it was so disappointing.
Other questions? Yes. Yeah,
although I just have to say, you know, this reminds me, you were on the radio talking with Andre Sultner, and it just flashed through my mind his remark that I just have never gotten over. He said when he opened the restaurant, the only fresh herb you could get in New York was parsley. My jaw dropped, and it sort of stayed dropped ever since.
I mean, I used to do, when I first was in California doing interviews with chefs, there wasn't any. There were no herbs. There were no local cheeses. I mean, it's hard to remember how fast things have changed.
Yeah, yeah. The early 80s even, it was different. When I talked to Alfred Portale at Gotham Bar and Grill in connection with this book, and he was reminiscing about scrambling to get all these things you take for granted now, just having to stitch together any kind of little, what we're talking about, something beyond parsley or fish that was just not supermarket flounder, and they had there's a lot of just on the spur invention and creation of little midget companies that would go out and get this stuff and make it available to chefs, and it's just been a revolution in the last 25 years.
You've talked about restaurants in Manhattan in the 1880s and the 1890s. And I was curious about the state of restaurants in Manhattan during the Depression and how the Depression affected them, and certainly given, you know, where we are today.
Well, the Depression was, keep in mind that Prohibition had dealt the first huge blow to New York dining. It was an annihilating event. It erased a century of progress in a matter of months. And the Depression, Prohibition was still on when the Depression started. So you had a double blow of the economic collapse. What you found was a creative response from people like this crazy physical culture entrepreneur by the name of Bernard McFadden, who opened Penny Restaurants. He had made millions with the New York Graphic and his kind of exercise magazines, and he, with his foundation, he opened a bunch of restaurants around New York where you could, all the dishes were one penny. So that was a creative response. Occasionally you would find these fancy French restaurants still struggling along and trying, you know, no matter how depressed the Depression was in New York, there were still all, you look at the New Yorker cartoons at the time and you see those people in the fur coats getting into the limousines and cursing Roosevelt. And they all went to these certain French restaurants, which even opened during the Depression and did business. But most people, you know, there was the Automat. There were these really good chain restaurants that, like Child's, that were kind of lunch rooms but done on a more sort of efficient and clean basis that served the masses, or at least people with limited means. It wasn't a great period for New York dining. I mean, these things, even in my experience at the paper, you know, the fluctuations, the restaurant economy is so sensitive that I happened to be reviewing restaurants when it was a very boom period of several years, and you could tell it because I was racing just to keep up with restaurants that were opening, and I think now Sam Sifton, the new guy, is looking at the lineup of restaurants coming online and thinking, gosh, you know, God, looks a little thin out there. So in the Depression, I think that the explosion at the end of the reason I spend so much time talking about the World's Fair in New York was it was such an exciting breath of life after this horrible period from 1920 to 1939. That's a long time to have a slump in dining. And there was there was color back in New York with the World's Fair. Although, of course, what came around the corner, World War II. So not a great period overall.
Yeah, there are hands over.
About the change in taste, actual taste palate of the public today. I see this because I sell fish, smoked fish and herring on the Lower East Side, where the family's been doing it for 100 years. And I've noticed changes in getting away from salt or in not eating bones, and they want it easier. They don't want the bones. They don't want the fat fish. And I assume that's affected the restaurant trade as well.
Well, not really. Not in my restaurant. I've seen the opposite trend. So for every trend, there's a counter trend. And the counter trend is almost the exact opposite of what you said. People want things with more bones and want foods that have salinity or tremendous amounts of flavor and are willing to both seek it out and pay for it. And, I can only speak from in this sense, from my perspective, which is when they know where the bones are coming from, they're more likely to want to chew them.
Yeah, I mean, luckily, every half the restaurants in New York are now serving marrow bones, yeah. You couldn't even have imagined that 5 years ago. The thing that we noticed at the magazine was that the American taste for spice, for heat, for chili heat, exploded in the last 5 years. I mean, things that we wouldn't have dreamed of printing because they were just too hot, we were suddenly saying maybe we could make it a little hotter. That the taste for acidity went up. That suddenly people wanted more vinegar, more lemon juice. That there was a much bigger willingness to experiment with new spices. And that very, very slowly there is a new appetite for nose-to-tail eating, that we certainly couldn't have printed as many awful recipes as we did in the early 40s when there were tons of recipes for, you know, kidneys, hearts, tripes, sweetbreads, livers, and that's moderated some.
Yeah.
But it's starting to creep back in where you're starting to be able to run recipes for not kidneys so much, but certainly liver and even occasionally tripe.
Yeah, those are the biggest requests that when they come to my restaurant, of brains and kidneys and livers, and that just does not stay in the kitchen. So I don't know, maybe it'll hit the Lower East Side by the end of the year.
But certainly there is a real desire to eat less fat and to replace fat with what we were calling umami or power ingredients, and to try and think of ways of ratcheting up the flavor without throwing in butter or meat fat.
Is this on?
Yeah.
This is a question for the restaurant critics. You wield such enormous power, and it's within your grasp to change the fortunes either up or down for a restaurant, any given restaurant. I remember a conversation I had with someone in the food business about 20 years ago, and she told me that one of your predecessors, a restaurant critic for the Times, adjusted the ratings up or down based on two criteria, one of them being the number of rolls that are served, and the other one being the temperature of the restaurant, especially during the hot days of summer. I'm not going to name the critic, but I suspect you know who it was. But
I don't have a clue who it was. I can't imagine that that's true.
Well, yeah, that sounds kind of...
I don't think this person had any reason to lie to me. If that's the case, how do you control such petty personal prejudices in writing a review? And a follow-up question, if your editor knows about this, how does the editor control you?
Well, certainly in my experience at the New York Times, the editors were extremely hands-off. I mean, I had been told before I went there that the editors were the ones who, you know, just determined the stars and told you where to go. Well, that couldn't have been less true. No one ever told me where to go, and I imagine that's true for you, or mm-hmm. in any way weighed in on the stars.
Or how many roles you were served?
My sense of that story is that the restaurateur you're describing, first of all, I don't know how he could have known that that was the reason for the adjustment of a star, unless he was inside the mind of the critic, or if this person in an unguarded moment said, yeah, I took them down because they had three rolls and I wanted, and that's too many rolls to get before dinner, or I was hungry and I wanted four rolls and they should have realized I wanted four rolls. Listen, there are big considerations when you go into a restaurant and the number of rolls is so far down on the list of what you're worrying about. It's very hard for me to believe that that's going to determine, you know, adding or taking away a star. You may find it's hard to believe, but critics go in hoping they're going to get a great meal. And they're so happy when they do get a good meal and are able to transmit that joy to the readership. Those were the best weeks of my life when I would hit a restaurant that was just clicking on all cylinders and I could communicate my happiness to the people who put down their money for the newspaper. And it's no fun to go to a restaurant where your pleasant expectations are dashed and then have to write about that. Unless it's Hudson Cafeteria, in which case that is just a holiday.
That's great.
But I hope, you know, I think that the... I think critics tend to be rather... looking into my own soul, I think tend to be rather generous in spirit and not nitpicky and fault-finding on the small scale. I mean, they're usually thinking of the bigger issues when they go into a restaurant. There's plenty of big things to talk about.
And certainly, part of the job is you overcome your own prejudices. I mean, everybody has certain things that they like less than others, and part of being professional is that you judge them on their own merits, whether it happens to be to your taste or not.
Also, all restaurateurs think they deserve one more star than they really do. That's just a fact of life.
You had a question in the middle of it. Hold on.
This question is for Mr. Barber. How... if at all, are you influenced by reviews that you get? And do you make any conscious changes based on those, or you try to ignore them?
You know, I got a bad one yesterday. So your question's really timely, because I'm still figuring out exactly how to react to it. I don't say this in any kind of haughty way. It's one of the first ones we've gotten for negative for Blue Hill, New York. And it really hurt. I have to say, like, I pretended, that it didn't hurt. But, oh, my God, it was really hard to read, especially because in my hubris, I talked to the reviewer on the phone for about a half an hour. I must have gassed on a little too long because I thought it was going to be a stunning review. I mean, I really had this wrong by several stars and then some. So I felt like particularly embarrassed, just because I had sort of played it up to the staff that this was going to be. I mean, not exactly, but I definitely made it out to seem like this was going to be celebratory. So So how do I react to it? At family meal, I brought everybody in. I don't want to say it was a meaningless review, but it was the kind of review that someone would maybe find out about the next day, or it wasn't a New York Times review, is what I'm trying to say. So,
do you want to say where it was?
It was Bloomberg News. I'm fine with that. The reviewer had been, and basically the reviewer compared Blue Hill, New York to Blue Hill at Stone Barns and said, for your money, Blue Hill at Stone Barns is the better restaurant. The Obamas made a mistake. You know, there's kind of like a little like cheese ballish, I thought. But had some things to say that I had already felt. And so, you know, I brought the whole kitchen staff in, and we have a lot of new, young new cooks, and it really made some pointed comments about the food and said that the food was just not good, and gave some examples for which I'm explaining to you that I already felt. So I you know, just kind of called a spade, and I made it very clear that comparing the two restaurants was a ridiculous comparison. It's apples and oranges. It's completely different execution of food, completely different atmosphere for executing that food, completely different price point. It's comparing this library to a branch library that just makes no sense in terms of resources. But the comments that he had to make meant that there was some work to do, and that in this particular case, the you know, one of the luxuries that I had when Mr. Grimes came to review our restaurant was that we were totally unknown, and when the reviewer for Ruth, Jonathan Gold, came, totally unknown, you know, and when we opened up Blue Hill, New York, it was I really wanted a low ceiling restaurant. I want a place that you came into and you had low expectations for. There was paper on the table, there wasn't great silverware, and you came in, and if the service and if the food met that low expectation, or in the rare times it did, superseded it, exceeded the expectations, what an incredible response. Because how often do we get our expectations superseded? Very, very rarely, whether it's theater or food or any of the arts. And so that's what I went for, and that was our big success, I think. I'm not being falsely modest. I think one of the big contributors was the expectation level was low. Now the expectation level, after the Obamas, after the success of Stone Barns, after the success of the restaurants in general, very hard to meet that in a place that seats 40 people, that has very low, too low ceilings, and the paper is a little too old on the table and whatnot. And so these are the kind of things that I tried to explain to the staff and say that it's a challenge, and that the challenge now to the next phase of our existence is going to be much harder. So that's what I did. I don't know if it was the right thing to do. I mean, I, you know, there's some chefs, I've been at restaurants where chefs have gotten up after a mediocre or bad review and absolutely tore the reviewer apart and defended the staff up and down the aisle, and I felt like doing that, but I also felt like there was some fairness in what they were saying, and to put it in perspective probably meant that we could get something good out of it. And I have to tell you, last night's service, one of the best services I've ever worked at my own restaurant, so maybe I did an okay job.
Can say how they feel.
Oh. The question's about what do you feel about the blogosphere and that everybody's a critic these days. So
I feel fine about it. I just the whole premise behind sort of the enterprise at the Times is that you get an opinion and a voice that you like and trust, and that there's a commitment behind the newspaper to providing a quality, informed opinion. And I don't think you get that guarantee. It's the Wild West in the blogosphere. You may get absolutely super brilliant, great writers who know a lot about food, and it's really worth following the blog and reading it. And you get a lot of complete idiots. So there's no, you just have to pick your way through it all. And it's, to the extent, this is the big debate of the day. I mean, is this democratization of food criticism going to dilute the power of traditional food critics? And, you know, to a certain extent, it seems that logical to say, well, yes, it would have to, because in London, when you go, you don't have one all-powerful theater critic. You have all these national newspapers, and you have 12 or 13 theater critics, and it diffuses opinion. And it's pretty good, I think, to have that. How it's going to work in New York as far as food goes, I think it's an open question. I don't think it's as obvious an answer as, yeah, you got all these other critics, and therefore the equation is going to be plus for them is minus for us folks, because if you talk to restaurant owners, for example, ask them whether they care whether the Times comes in and gives them a you know, a zero-star review, and I think they're not going to say, well, it doesn't matter because we'll make up for it with all these people who come in and do, you know, blah-blah.com, and they'll and they're gonna talk about how much they love the place.
So. I think it's a fascinating time because we're at a point in our culture where restaurant critics have never been more closely read or held less power, because I think it's undeniable that the power has been diluted by all these other voices out there. And what it does is it puts the burden on the institutions who are hiring That's restaurant right. critics to make them better writers, more authoritative. I mean, they really now have to stand out. And what it means is that there have been for a long time a lot of people out there writing for respectable institutions who just weren't that good, weren't that knowledgeable, didn't write that well. And, you know, it really means that if you're paying for an opinion as opposed to just going online, you want it to teach you something, be authoritative, and be a great read.
I learn a lot from the blogosphere, but I more with what was said here. So I was told that we should run this as much time as an analyst gives you as a patient. And I don't know where we are in the session, but maybe we'll.
And when he said that, he said 78 minutes, and I thought,
it's like, who's your analyst? yes, in the back. We're gonna take the last two questions, let's say, and then we'll.
Perhaps, Chef, what are some of the ideas that you've poached that you think, I am going to bring these back?
You first.
Let me see. What would I like to see again? Well, I would like to see more kidneys on toast. That was a big dish in the steakhouses around Times Square. And I'd like to see more fat, which has just become anathema everywhere, and I know that it's, you know, it's almost like saying I want to see slavery reintroduced or something. It's so retrograde. But I went to Germany a couple of years ago and I ate at this kind of farmhouse restaurant where they were reintroducing this breed of pig that had almost disappeared. There were about 12 of them left 20 years ago, and in bringing back this breed, they brought back the luscious taste and sensation, mouth-filling sensation of what pig is supposed to be, which is like a decent amount of fat on it rather than this cardboard.
Somebody's raising those here now. We did a piece about it.
Uh-huh. So that's one of my wishes that will never come true, but except in very isolated little pockets of resistance.
What do you mean never come true? Come to Stonebarts. We're raising them. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
My favorite short story of all time probably is All You Can Eat for $5 by Joseph Mitchell. And I yearn for someone to bring back the beefsteak, a great New York institution.
I would go with what Bill Grimes said here with these breeds and varieties of vegetables. Breeds of meats that have been lost and to recapture them. And I don't, again, mean that in just the most nostalgic way, as like turning back the clock and getting all the stuff that we used to have in terms of the diversity and the plate and the biodiversity on the farm. But I would marry that with some of the breeders that are out there that we're trying to work with more and more. I think it's an absolutely fascinating field of taking breeds, older varieties of breeds, regionalizing them, in other words, making them adaptable to the Hudson Valley, in our case, and making them thrive in ways that, in flavor ways that, and in economic return for farmers, in other words, they grow well, they don't have a big failure rate, in ways that we haven't even begun to scratch the surface on. That the trend of, you know, the chef knowing the farmer and the chef going to the farmer's way, it's a great story, but it's been told so much, and it's like, you know, it's one of those things that's becoming a little old and a little bit co-opted by people who actually really don't do it. So you know, I think if going, you know, dialing back to the beginning of this this session. You know, if we were talking about the tectonic shift of the diner having the power and now the chef having the power, maybe the next tectonic shift is the breeders and the farmers who are willing to support the breeders, because that's really the big problem, is that there are very few farmers who are willing to take on the technology that breeders at land-grant universities, at Cornell is one, a great example in New York, that are taking some of these old onions that haven't been grown in New York State in 100 years and re-regionalizing them and getting flavors that you just absolutely cannot imagine. Also, storage ability for the winter, so relocalizing the economy. Anyway, this is in the hands of brilliant scientists that we need to support, both chefs and farmers need to support. So if that was a trend that was old, I don't know, but sort of marrying this idea of this diversity on the farm and bringing it to the plate, I think is the next trend or the next place where chefs really need to concentrate and focus their passion and their attention.
Hey guys, so right here?
Yeah.
Hi. by the way, Ruth, the beefsteak is actually coming back to New York this Sunday, and it's happening in Brooklyn, so someone did bring it back. But
where?
My question, at the Bell House. But my question is, right now it seems like we're going through this phase of, you know, molecular gastronomy and really new cooking techniques like sous vide and, you know, hydrocolloids and liquid nitrogen. It has its supporters, it has its detractors. A lot of the people say to the detractors, well, you know, once upon a time, cooking over an open flame was a weird thing. In the history of kind of New York, have there been other techniques that we think about today that are just normal that were met with, like, reluctance and pushback?
Gas flame. The transition from coal to gas was a hugely, chefs were very divided about that in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. Mm. And there was a lot of resistance to the idea that, well, they knew how to cook with coal, and gas was the kind of the X factor. A lot of them felt that it dried out food in a way that coal fire didn't. I suspect that perhaps the early gas wasn't that consistent. That maybe it tended to. I don't know enough about the technology of gas, but it seemed, my impression was that maybe the supply wasn't as stable as it is today, and that therefore it wasn't consistent for chefs to use. So anyway, that's a big example. Just source of heat, that's about as basic as you can get for a restaurant.
I mean, I would say in home cooking, the introduction of the Cuisinart was met, or the food processor was met with enormous skepticism. What did you need that for? That was something that was highfalutin and for chefs, and why would anybody want that in their own home? And, you know, now I would venture to say there are very few people who cook in this room who don't have some kind of a food processor.
Yeah, I use a lot of the technologies that you mentioned, and I get a lot of flack for it on the blogosphere, by the way, because why as a farmer, you know, why as a chef, here I am talking about what I really want to be as a farmer, but why as a chef, you know, who's so espousing the slow food as the aesthetic and conceit, why would he be so enamored with all the latest technologies? And
It is irritating that you're supposed to be a Luddite
exactly.
If you're
yeah,
interested
right.
in real food.
Yeah. She said it better than I would. Yeah.
One pushy last one?
Yeah.
I recently had a meal in one of the few 3-star Michelin restaurants in New York, which was incomprehensible. Everyone at the table rated it 0 stars. We just couldn't understand. We said, this is beyond a bad night. We wouldn't know what to tell them to improve. There's so many things. And it was kind of Monty Python-like. And I wonder, reviewers go in multiple times into a restaurant for a given review, correct? Mm-hmm. What kind of variability in experience would you say you had in the very top-of-the-line restaurants?
But before we answer that, can I just vent a little bit? It just drives me crazy that New Yorkers are suddenly taking a French critic's idea of what our restaurant should
be. Good for you, Ruth. That's great.
It just, what do the French know about what our tastes are, and why do we give them that power? It's just irritating.
Hello?
Yeah.
We had to send food back. They kept on pouring bubbly water and flat water, I mean, five times, dropping, I mean, it was, I'm not being...
You're not a reviewer for Bloomberg News.
No, no.
Maybe
stars, there's...
Maybe they were breaking in a new waiter or something.
It's not about your experience and variability is what I'm interested in.
I did not find at the level you're talking about, I didn't find where I would go in one night and it was absolute disaster comedy of errors, and I'd go back 4 days later and suddenly the service was perfect and everything was fine-tuned. The variability was in a much narrower range. And this sounds like, whatever you're talking about, sounds like some unaccountable disaster having to do with maybe people not showing up or, no. You know, a story behind the story there. Or else maybe the story is behind whoever was reviewing that restaurant. I don't know.
I mean, every restaurant has a bad night. I'm sure you've had disaster nights in your restaurant that...
I was going to say, I think you could have come. I don't have three Michelin stars, but and thankfully now I don't care that I don't. you could have come to Blue Hill at Stone Barns and paid a lot of money for a meal that you were extremely disappointed in and had kind of, what did you say, Kafkaesque overtones or I don't know what you said, but sounded miserable. And I think that happens to us more often than, I like to admit. I think it'd be very hard to come back to my restaurant or to a Michelin three-star restaurant and have that experience twice, which is why reviewers should be doing it more than once. But to have it once and have it be sort of a laughable experience and how could, Ruth or Bill have given that three stars, I think is really possible. And the reasons for that, just as were mentioned, there's always a story. There's people who don't show up. There's disasters that happen there's so many variables that it's a more frequent occurrence than I care to admit, although I just admitted it, so. Okay, thank you.